It's time to say goodnight to inefficient night storage heaters. Bulky, unattractive, with no precise control, leaving you boiling in the morning and rather chilly at night. So tune in to Fisher Future Heat, home heating systems that give you a steady, controllable supply of heat 24 hours a day. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric.
Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Tristan Riddell.
And I'm Matt Hansen.
And you're listening to the Nerd Party.
Talk nerdy to me.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
This is episode 7, and today we are talking about sequels. That's right, sequels. The week before, we were talking about remakes, and it just felt natural to go towards sequels. And what we're going to do today, the format of today's show is going to be very much like the remakes, where we're going to talk about what we liked, what sequels we think worked. Not necessarily sequels that were better than the original, but they could be, but mainly sequels that we liked. And also, because you have to, it's the yin and the yang, you got to talk about sequels that we think didn't work and maybe some in between. But before we get into that, we'd like to start off with a little news. And let's start off with some personal news. Matt, what would you like to share?
Well, Tristan, last time we talked on our show, we briefly mentioned the Star Trek reboots, 09 and Into Darkness, and some of the negativity surrounding them and how that was getting a little bit overwhelming for fans of the new movies like myself. So I do want to report a somewhat positive follow-up, though. A couple weeks back, since we had that conversation, I bought the new Star Trek compendium release for, if those of you who don't know, that is the re-release of the two new Abrams films with all of the Into Darkness special material intact on one disc.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, when they released Star Trek Into Darkness, it was just a huge cluster. It was insane because they had like special features that were only available at Target or only available at Best Buy or only available at Walmart. There was not a single disc that contained all of the special features, and they just now came out with it.
Yeah, I don't know what Paramount was thinking. Maybe they were trying to do something different, but thankfully they gave what they should have given about a year ago. Yes, it's a year late, but it's on disc now, and I'm happy to have it in my hands. And it was for the first time in a long time, Tristan, that I actually sat down to watch the Abrams films again, just because, like I mentioned last show, there's just so much negativity and stuff surrounding it that it made me not even really want to watch them anymore, just because it's always weighing on the back of my mind. I got this new set, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to watch these films again. I'm just going to block out all the background noise and just focus on the movie. And you know what? It sitting down and watching them again like that really reminded me why I'm such a fan of these new movies and why I really shouldn't care what other people think and why I am wholeheartedly looking forward to the next installment. So I was able to rediscover my fandom for the new films in the nicest possible way. So there is a happy ending to that story.
Yeah, I didn't buy the compendium because I already own them, and I am not as big of a fan of Into Darkness as you are, but I did get the digital codes from a friend of ours and who is also a fan of the show, and just recently gave us a 5-star review on the UK iTunes store, and you can find him at Lee_Nostromo. He's been our biggest cheerleader for the show, and he's a big Bond fan and Alien fan. He's just a lot of fun to talk to, and so we thank you for your 5-star review. But yeah, anyway, so like I got the codes. I haven't been able to check the UV codes yet, but I checked the iTunes code, and they don't give us the IMAX versions, which you get in the discs of the compendium, which is the big draw for me. So, but I haven't checked the UVs yet.
I don't know. How do you do IMAX on a computer? I mean, it just seems like it's a format that would be more suited to like a big screen TV.
For the IMAX version of Into Darkness is an aspect ratio of 1.85, if I am correct. A true IMAX film is actually much more like a square.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher Nolan really made it famous in The Dark Knight and like made it palatable for movies instead of just like, oh, you know, like NASA or... And, you know, the Grand Canyon, you know, like things like that.
Yeah.
It's a square format. And J.J. Abrams did it for Into Darkness, for a few scenes in Into Darkness. And he presented it with a 1.85, which is close to a 1.78, which is what your big screen TV aspect ratio is. But the rest of the film is 2.39, which is much skinnier, much wider. And for those of you listening at home, I could be getting my aspect ratios off, but it's that's the major difference, is that you have, in the IMAX version, you have certain scenes that would be formatted for 16:9, and then you have other scenes that are 2.39 or 2.40, which is much skinnier. And in the iTunes versions, it was all 2.39.
See, but my question kind of was, like, it just seems to me that I don't know why they would include it on, like, an iTunes version or a something that you would play on your computer, because it just seems to me that, like, if you're going to do something IMAX, it's more suited for, like, a television screen rather than a computer screen. You know what
but
I mean?
But I have an Apple TV.
But that's a TV. But again, keyword there being TV. Like, it's a big screen TV.
Yeah, it's a big screen TV, but I can watch my iTunes versions on my big screen TV.
Well, yeah, but not everybody has an Apple TV, Tristan.
A lot of people have an Apple TV.
It's a very popular device. They're getting more common, I will say. And I think that as years go on, you will see more IMAX versions being adapted for iTunes. I don't think the prevalence is quite there yet. It's getting there. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that you and one other person I know has an Apple TV.
It is a very, I'll have to throw some numbers at you. I'll have to do some research, because it's a very popular device. And also the thing is, though, that an IMAX version would fill up more screen on your computer more so than a TV. So I'd have to argue with you. I'd have to argue the opposite with you.
Well, I'm just saying, I don't know if you would get the full effect on a 15-inch, you know, laptop screen than you would on a...
Either way, I think you're hurting yourself by watching it on a 15-inch screen.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't have, I don't make the big bucks yet to get a nice, huge-ass screen.
Well, okay, speaking of watching movies over the weekend, there's two movies that I, new releases that I watched, and that's A Million Ways to Die in the West and Live, Die, Repeat, Edge of Tomorrow, because that's what they're calling it now. That's the rebranding. It's so stupid. And the colon kind of makes me think, okay, are they going to try to do a sequel? Or is the colon just because they're trying to rebrand it and not completely erase the original title from people's minds?
Well, I think it's more likely the second one, because Live, Die, Repeat, like, you know, the constant not as savvy shopper or moviegoer would be like, I don't remember a movie called Live, Die, Repeat that came out this summer. And then they see The Edge of Tomorrow. It's like, oh, yes, I do remember An Edge of Tomorrow or something.
They realize that they didn't market it well, and I think that's what they're blaming the low income, the low domestic on, because it only made, to date, $100 million domestic, and it cost $178 million.
And it just cracked $100 million, like, last month.
And worldwide, altogether, it's almost $370 million. And you need to double your money in order to consider it not a flop. And at least, you know, that's what some people say. And, you know, it achieved that, but just barely. And that's if you don't factor in the advertising costs.
Right. So it's usually a rule of thumb that it's about 2.5 times to be profitable.
There you go. Okay. So I was going off old school.
I'm guessing.
Well, I watched it. And the thing is it didn't make a lot of money. But the critics loved it. It got a 90% on Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's a very solid film. It didn't blow my hair back, but I liked it. It was good. It was like a sci-fi version of Groundhog's Day. And I think that's cool.
I would have to see it, because I keep hearing it described that way. And I think to myself, that's kind of miserable. But I'm sure it's all in the execution of the story.
Yeah, it's all in the execution, and it's all in the editing. Like, the editing was very good, because they did it in a way where you didn't get bored, and they showed you enough new material to keep moving the story along, where he would change his day a couple of different ways, or he would interact with new people. And they did it from different angles and different tracking shots and things like that. And so it wasn't just like copy, repeat, or anything like that.
So they caused and affected it?
They caused and affected it. Very nice. And the other one I watched, so you need to watch it, because it's not because it's mind-blowing, but just because it's an entertaining film, and that's all you need to take away from it.
I definitely want to see it.
And the other film I watched, which isn't really a genre film, but I mean, it's a Western, so it's A Million Ways to Die in the West. I'm a big Seth MacFarlane fan.
So am I. Like, I know the guy gets a lot of garbage these days. I personally... He got a lot of garbage after the Oscars last year, and personally, I thought it was one of the most unique, funniest Oscars that I've seen in a long time.
I thought those Oscars were hysterical, and I thought he did a great job, and I don't know why he got some flack, because if... He could have been boring, but he wasn't. He was funny, and there was a few times he went a little blue, but that's Seth MacFarlane. You know what you're getting when you get Seth MacFarlane.
Or at least you should. I mean, like, that's why I didn't understand all the backlash that he got, because you hire Seth MacFarlane to do something very specific. You can't get mad at him for doing his shtick, because that's what you theoretically hired him on.
Yeah, and exactly. And the thing is, though, is like he wasn't like a jackass like Ricky Gervais or anything like that. And they hired Ricky Gervais back just because he got press for being such a jerk. At least Seth MacFarlane wasn't a jerk. He was just funny and a little off color. But anyway, I was a big fan of Ted. I think Ted was really funny.
I loved that movie. The critic liked
it. It made good money. Yeah, I liked it too. And I was like, wow, Seth MacFarlane's a pretty good director. And then when I was tracking A Million Ways to Die in the West ever since it was announced and ever since they started writing it, I was like, I cannot wait for a Seth MacFarlane Western film. And have you seen it? Have you seen it yet?
I've not seen it yet. I know it's gotten bad response. I know a lot of people have crapped on it, but I still kind of want to see it because I'm still in the Seth MacFarlane camp, so...
Yeah, and so am I. Even after watching this film, so am I. It got a 33%, I think, on Rotten Tomatoes, either 33 or 31, as opposed to a 68 that Ted got. And the thing is the difference is there. It's worth it. Like, 68, I think, was a little low for Ted, but, you know, like, a lot of people don't like the crass humor. And I don't really like the crass humor that much, but I thought Ted walked the line. With A Million Ways to Die in the West, there was a lot of times when they crossed the line. The first act was amazing. It was really funny, really great, heavy-hitting jokes, one after the other, and then it kind of petered out towards the second act and just kind of down into the third act.
Now, I have to ask you a question. Do you think one of the major differences in quality could be, and I'm not, again, this is not to crap on Seth MacFarlane because I am a fan, but is he better when he's not physically there if he's just doing voiceover?
No, I didn't think that at all. I felt like he did a great job acting. I think he needs to lay off the Botox, but other than that, I think he did a fine job. He was really funny. Like he had great mannerisms, great physical humor, and he was good. I mean, he was a natural. You didn't think anything of it. You didn't think like, oh, that guy's a voice actor trying to make it. How sad. No, he was a very good performer. Just like we saw in at the Oscars. The main thing was, it was story-wise. Like, it could have been 30 to 40 minutes shorter.
Okay.
And the editor could have compacted it a whole lot more, and they relied on toilet humor a bit too much for my taste.
Well, again, that's more, I've been keeping up with the later seasons of Family Guy, and there's more of that than there used to be. But I still want to check it out, and I'm still looking forward to Ted 2 next year.
I cannot wait for Ted 2. I know nothing about the story, but I can't wait because I love that teddy bear, and God love him. I like Mark Wahlberg in Ted. I never thought I'd say that I like Mark Wahlberg, but
he's a good. I'll give this Mark Wahlberg this when he's given a good script, he can be a good comedic actor. He's got good timing.
I think you're right. I mean, I didn't want that to sound like I was crapping all over Mark Wahlberg because I do enjoy some of his performances. I loved him in The Fighter. I think that was a great performance.
He just needs a good script, and I think he's very capable if given a good script. But when you give him a bad script, it turns out to be a disaster, i.e. Transformers this last summer.
Oh, yeah. Don't even get me started. All right. Well, we've talked about our weekend viewing, and we've gone on a little long about that. But let's just go right into our topic, and let's talk about sequels. Sequels, sequels, sequels. Let's talk about some sequels that... we like. I mean, last time I gave a few, you gave a few, but let's talk about the obvious ones first. Let's talk about the ones that we absolutely know are on each other's list for sequels that absolutely worked. And I don't think you can have a sequel conversation without talking about The Godfather Part 2 first. There is something special about The Godfather Part 2 because the first Godfather, and what is there to say that hasn't already been said about The Godfather, but The Godfather is a Hallmark movie. It is And I don't mean that like the Hallmark Channel. It's,
no, it's certainly not one of those.
Yeah, it's certainly not one of those. It's just, it's so well written, so well acted, so well directed, edited. It just set design, everything. There's not a single weak link in that movie. And in Godfather Part II, it's even better. And it's even longer. And you get Bobby De Niro. It's just mind-blowing.
Bobby De Niro, like you have lunch with him on Thursdays.
I do have lunch with him on Thursdays, and we always get the Nisa salad. So thank you very much.
But it begs the question, does even, like, I know in all aspects it is a sequel technically, but it doesn't even really feel like a sequel to me. It feels like a continuation of a story, which I know that's what a sequel is, but it's a unique kind of sequel. I don't know, there's something about it that feels different than your run-of-the-mill sequel.
It almost feels, I think that's the reason why they call it Part 2 instead of The Godfather 2 or The Godfather colon something. And actually, when was the colon something introduced? It feels like a sci-fi thing.
It must be a sci-fi thing. I certainly by the time we get to Star Trek movies in the late 70s and 80s, those have the colon in them. And I want to say maybe even, because when the Star Wars movies were first released, they weren't called, it was just Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. They weren't called Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back or Star Wars, Return of the Jedi yet, were they? I think they had all three distinct titles. I think Star Wars was just the what we could now call A New Hope.
Yeah. In 1977, it was just Star Wars. That's it. But then they re-released it in theaters, and it was Star Wars, A New Hope, Episode 4.
I think it's a product of the late 70s and early 80s when the colon and the subtitles start to come into it.
I think you're right. And it's just, we could do an entire retrospective on The Godfather or Francis Ford Coppola's work, and I'm sure that we will. But this one, it's just the acting and the stories and the plot is much more in depth. It's much more introspective than the first one. And I feel like that's really, really where it hit home. And there's in-family betrayal, because in the first one you had like people within the family, as in people who worked for the family, betrayal. But then in Godfather Part II, you have the infamous scene with Fredo.
Yeah.
And this is, and not only did Fredo betray Michael, but Michael takes him out. That is just, like, that alone is enough to put it above the original. And so, yeah, that's what I have to say about that.
No, that's definitely, like, a quality choice. And I'm sure when we talk about sequels that perhaps weren't so good, we're going to talk about Godfather 3.
That's something that I'd like to talk about in the middle as we transition into sequels that don't work.
I know, because you have a little bit different opinion than most people on Godfather 3.
I do, and we'll get into that. But before we do, and I'm glad that you mentioned Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, because Empire Strikes Back is a movie that I think is arguably better than Star Wars. But can you call it a sequel? Because a lot of people say, no, it's not a sequel because it's part of a planned trilogy, much like Back to the Future.
See, here's my feeling on it. When I watch A New Hope, it's hard to get the outside knowledge that there's more movies out of it. But New Hope ends where, if that had been the only one that was made, it does have a conclusive ending. Yes, Vader's still out there and that sort of stuff, but the Death Star has been destroyed. Huge victory for the Rebels. It ends on a positive note. You know, you get the metal scene at the end, and that feels like it could work as its own conclusion. It's not exactly a complete story, but it's a conclusion. Once you make Empire, that is blatantly open-ended.
And yes, very much so. And you need Return of the Jedi, or otherwise it just doesn't work. And so would you call Empire Strikes Back a sequel, or would you call it a part of a planned trilogy?
See, it's really hard to make that distinction. I guess it in strictest terms, it is part of a planned trilogy. I will give it this, though. It's still the best Star Wars film to date.
It is pretty amazing. And so for the sake of this argument, let's say that Empire Strikes Back is a sequel. And even if it's part of a planned trilogy, it's the next installment. So, yeah, I'd say, like, that's one that has to be on this list because of that reason. And even though Star Wars, a.k.a. A New Hope, is iconic, and that is the movie that you think about when you think the anthology of Star Wars, the prequels and the originals, as well as the upcoming sequels, that is the movie. That's the movie that pops in your head. No matter how great Empire is, no matter how great Jedi is, that is the image that pops in your head. And so it's hard to combat that and its effect on our culture. But Empire has better acting, better direction, better writing.
Better drama.
Better drama. And I think the key component to that is that it's not directed by Lucas and it wasn't written by Lucas.
Did that set the precedent? Because it seems like, especially in trilogies nowadays, or when you're telling a trilogy-like story, it seems like the second chapter in that trilogy is always the darkest. Like, and it seems like that precedent was set by this one.
I think an argument could be made that Godfather Part II is the darker of the two, of the original and the sequel.
I agree, but I'm talking about for blockbuster films, because Godfather is an iconic film, and I'm not trying to take that away from it, but it's not like the term blockbuster and what we consider now to be the Hollywood blockbuster didn't come out till the subsequent year with Jaws in 75. So I think it kind of, as far as blockbuster, big budget Hollywood sequels go,
I think you're right. I don't know if I wouldn't use the term blockbuster, because people did come out in droves to see it and go yes. around the block. But if you, in terms of genre films, yes, I think an argument could be made that Empire kind of set that trend, because you got to go somewhere. And whenever you raise the bar or raise the level when it comes to drama and or action or story and plot, sometimes in order to hit it harder, you have to go darker. And I think Empire Strikes Back showed that, proved that.
Because I'm thinking now, and I'm sure we're going to talk about when we get to sequels that aren't necessarily on everybody's list, but things that I think are really spectacular. In terms of today's like modern superhero genre films, the second one is usually the stuff when, not to cuss on this show, but when crap gets real, in the sense.
Yeah.
It always seems to me that it's that second film where like some major things are uncovered, and then the main characters are going to go through some really, really hard times.
Well, I mean, we've talked about the first two iconic sequels. Like, when you think great sequels that surpass their original, you think Godfather Part II and Empire Strikes Back, if you consider Empire a sequel. So now that we've got that out of the way, how about you give me a few of the ones that are on your list?
Well, the ones that are on my list, some are horror-related and some are superhero-related and some are recent, which I kind of feel is an interesting turn of events, because growing up, Tristan, and we had this clip as our teaser last week, sequels were always usually seen as inferior. Mm-hmm. Like, they were lesser versions of their original films. And it just seems to me like, especially these days, in this day and age, when franchises are being planned out, sequels are actually starting to get better than their original. Like, it's becoming more of the norm where you get like the standout sequel. We had just thinking about the summer, we had three that come to my mind. I think for me, no sequel discussion could be complete, and we'll be having this discussion soon again without Aliens from 1986.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's definitely on my list too. We're going to talk about this on a much larger scale. So let's try to save some of that conversation. But I do not like this more than the original. But I think this is a very good movie.
Yeah, you fall into certain camps, because there are people who like Alien more and there are people who like Aliens more. But I can't think of too many people who, if they like one, they hate the other.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It just happens to be more their bag. I like... See, it's really hard for me to say, and I will talk about this soon, but I just like the vibe of Aliens more, and I like some of the character actors in Aliens more. But that's not to say that I don't love that first film and think and have such a wonderful time watching that first film, or even the atmosphere of that first film.
Yeah, and I think that's the key for me. But with the original, is that I love the feeling and the vibe and the je ne sais quoi about the alien, the retro future.
Would you agree, perhaps, though, that of the two films, Aliens is the more quotable one? Because you have you have several lines from there that people quote ad nauseum. And not to say that the dialogue in the original Alien was unmemorable, it certainly wasn't. But you don't have those lines that people still like bringing up to this day. I mean,
Game over, man!
Or, you know, I could probably quote that whole movie verbatim.
Yeah, no, it's I think it has a lot of memorable lines, and I think you know, Cameron is to blame for that. And I feel like, yeah, I feel like it's definitely much more quotable because it has a lot more dialogue than Alien did because of the nature of the two films. I mean, Alien is more of a horror film and Aliens is an action film. And with horror, you have a lot of walking around and creeping and snooping. And in Aliens, it's a lot of balls to the walls.
It's a war shooting. Film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Aliens is a war film. That's how I usually look at it. But it's still, it has some horror elements to it. I still get very, very tense in that film, which I think is admirable. But again, I think it also follows the pattern that I just mentioned with Empire, where in the second one, not that it becomes necessarily darker, but it becomes much more personal for Ripley.
Yes, yes, very much so. All right, well, I want to save some of that conversation for later. And speaking of saving the conversation for later, because we just talked about this at a great deal, and since we're on the Cameron kick, Terminator 2 is definitely on this list of sequels that work. And I know there's some people out there who think that the original is the absolute best, but I think you're wrong. I think Terminator 2 is iconic and brought it up to a new level.
But again, like Alien, that's not to say that the first Terminator is bad. The first Terminator is very good. It's for me, but for me, it's my second favorite.
Absolutely. And so I think that falls into that camp, and we won't go into it too in-depth, but I'll just give a few of my favorites rapid fire, and then maybe you can do the same. I'll give the first four. The Mummy Returns, Star Trek First Contact, Mission Impossible 3, and Scream 2. Now, with these, these are some of my favorites, and I know some people are probably thinking, why on earth is The Mummy Returns on this list?
I know, I was like, really?
Yeah, like, that's the one that probably sticks out in people's minds the most, and I loved Brendan Fraser's and Stephen Sommers' The Mummy. I thought it was great. I love Rachel Weisz. She's one of my favorite actresses. I thought it was fun. I thought it was well acted. And I thought the aesthetic was great. I thought it was scary. It was spooky. I just thought it was an overall great film. And The Mummy Returns, it's one of those sequels that's not necessarily, like, it doesn't have to go darker to be interesting. They went in the opposite direction, and it was even cooler where, like, they brought in a kid. And normally when you bring in a kid, it's not, like, it's horrible. But this kid was actually charming and fun. And they brought in, like, this big hot air balloon, dirigible. And it was just, there was so much about it where it kept the feeling of the original, but didn't make it as frightening. So they kind of moved away from the horror aspect and moved more to a family film. And I think it worked.
You're leaving out one of the big components that brought it in. That was The Rock. That was like one of his first major motion pictures.
That's when he was still known as The Rock, not Dwayne The Rock Johnson, not Dwayne Johnson, just The Rock. It spawned two other movies. It had the Scorpion King, and then it had The Mummy, Tomb of the Emperor, some Dragon Emperor, something like that. And that was just atrocious. That was an atrocious sequel.
No Rachel Weisz, no good. Right.
No Rachel Weisz, no good. I mean, and she turned down the script for a reason. That's the thing, is they didn't write her out. They just replaced her with a different actress. And she said, she's like, I didn't like the script, and I have a fully grown child in this that looks like he's in his 30s. Like, how am I supposed to be the mother of this child?
Not to mention, let's be honest, in between Mummy Returns and the third one, Rachel Weisz had gone on to actually have a real legit indie and award-winning career, because that's after Constant Gardener, that's after like she's in more critically acclaimed stuff, so
Oscar
not necessarily a need, like she doesn't need to go back to Mummy 3.
right. And with First Contact, you know, you could say like this is just another installment in the Star Trek series, but I consider this a direct sequel, because this is a sequel to the Next Generation Star Trek films. And Generations, I mean, I liked it, a lot of people didn't, but I felt like First Contact I don't even have to argue this. This is considered one of the best Star Trek movies of all time, next to Wrath of Khan. And I like it better than Wrath of Khan, but a lot of people consider that blasphemy. But that one is a little bit darker, a little bit more introspective, and a lot more action. And I just think it's all around better. And then you have Mission Impossible 3. And I feel like this was an apology for Mission Impossible 2, because I like John Woo, but I thought he was too aware of himself. And he tried to push himself into the series too much, and he's like, "Oh yeah, this is my signature, and this is my signature, and this is my signature."
So it became sort of self-parody in a sense.
I think that's a great way to put it. And it just wasn't fun. It wasn't cool. And then Mission Impossible 3. This was J.J. Abrams' directorial debut.
Yes, it was.
When I saw this, I was like, "Way to go, J.J. I can't wait to see more from you."
Little did you know how much of an impact he would have on other franchises that you like at the time.
I had no idea what was in store. And then, Scream 2.
Oh, Scream 2. Now, I have to ask you, is Scream 2, is it a situation where you like that more than Scream 1?
Like we said at the beginning of this podcast, this isn't necessarily a list of movies that are better than the original.
I know, but I'm asking you on personal preference.
But me, I've always had a struggle with that because Scream 1 is great and Scream 2 is great. And Scream 3 is not so great, and Scream 4, good lord. But
excuse me, I love Scream 4.
Okay, well, like, we're doing a Scream retrospective as well, and that might actually happen before the Aliens one. But Scream 2, I just thought it was great because it was very textbook. It was very, now they're in college. And so now we have a college campus to deal with, and now Ghostface has to run around these dormitories and these halls and these lecture halls. And it was just, I don't know, I just thought it was a lot of fun, and it was very aware of itself in a good way. I mean, Scream is that franchise that's aware of the horror genre and references itself a lot. And in last week's episode, we ended the show with a quote from Scream 2 talking about sequels, because in the first one, they talk about horror films. And in the second one, they talk about
sequels,
and in the third one they talk about trilogies, and in the fourth one they talk about remakes. It's just cool, and so I like it. I think it's more fun than the first one, but the first one is, I think, a little bit more. I don't want to say groundbreaking because that's used too much, but it was
the first time that sort of meta knowledge that we're bringing in the sort of Tarantino, Kevin Smith-esque dialogue and awareness to the horror genre. And it was desperately needed because a lot of the stuff that I'm going to bring up in the sequels that I like were all a result of the horror renaissance that was started by Scream.
So did you, what do you like more? Do you like Scream 1 and Scream 2 more?
That's very hard to say. Now, I liked the first one, and I really liked the second one. And yes, I like that fourth one. I saw it in theaters. I went at midnight to see it, and we'll talk about it when we get to our Scream retrospective, but it was, for me, it was a true return to form after the disastrous third one, because you had Williamson back writing most of the script. It was back to that self-awareness. It was back to just a lot of things that I really admired about that one. But those first two ones are really something special, and I can't really decide which one I like better. The first one referenced all the movies that I loved watching growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are scenes, now that you've seen it, there are scenes from that were from Halloween that are in that climax, playing in the background.
Yeah, yes.
That,
yeah.
I'm sure you recognized when they got to it in the film. But the sequel was really, like, one of the few sequels, horror sequels, that was really well done. So it's about an even keel for me.
All right. All right, well, how about you give me some rapid fire of your three or four or five greatest sequels.
Well, personal favorites and sequels.
There we go. Personal favorites.
We'll start off one with that I had no expectations for. Really, when you think of it, sounds like a really bad idea, and that's Psycho 2 from 1983. And the look on your face is the way most people react to something that's called Psycho 2. But I will say this: it was made by a director named Richard Franklin, who was a student of Hitchcock in the 70s and was responsible for a lot of the Hitchcock revivals, because back then there were no VHSs. So if you wanted to see a Hitchcock movie, you had to go to like special screenings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And Richard Franklin, having actually worked with the man and having known the man personally, would head up a lot of these special screenings. So he was a student of Hitchcock. So he knew a lot of the camera angles and how Hitchcock did things and his state of mind. So he's given the job of making Psycho 2. And you would think it would be a paint-by-number sequel where Anthony Perkins does come back. He's in Psycho 2. And actually, he comes back, and so does Vera Miles, who played Lila Crane, the living sister from Psycho 1. So they're both in this new film, and you would think it'd be this paint-by-number sequel where he gets out of the asylum and goes back and becomes crazy and starts killing all these people again. But what's really cool about this sequel is that they subvert your expectations, and people's motivations are not what you think they are, and actions are not what they appear to be. and it's very Hitchcockian. The guy keeps the air of the original alive, but brings an 80s sensibility to it, so it does feel like an 80s film. But the magic that made Psycho so kind of weird and different from other things that were around in that time are present in the sequel, and it's one of those few... Now, the ending, the very ending, is not the greatest, but there is enough good that comes from the, you know, 80-odd minutes that precede the ending that the man did a hell of a job for having to make a sequel to one of the most groundbreaking films of all time. So if you're hesitant about checking out Psycho 2, give it a try, and just realize it's not your paint-by-numbers sequel. I was very impressed.
I got you.
Second of all, sticking in the horror genre, and a movie that I hope to talk about at some point is Halloween H2O.
I want to see that really bad. I want to see Halloween H2O because I haven't.
Actually, as far as Halloween sequels go, Halloween, I can watch all the sequels minus one, which I'll talk about when we get to my bad ones. But I can watch all the Halloween sequels, even though they're not always the greatest. But if you want like good Halloween movies, the Halloween makes a great trilogy. And it's, in my opinion, it's 1, 2, and H2O, which is the seventh one. And the reason that I say that is because 1, 2, and H2O are all concerned with the Jamie Lee Curtis character, Laurie Strode. 2 is a good sequel, and I hope, Tristan, you might check that out at some time if we do a Halloween retrospective, only because it's a very unique sequel in the fact that it takes place the same night as Halloween 1.
I read about that. Like, I was trying to find a legal copy online, and for those of you at home, I was saying legal, not illegal, a legal copy to watch online, and there wasn't any that were, like, on Netflix or Hulu or, you know, like, or Crackle or things like that, because I watched Halloween for the first time over the weekend, and I read that Halloween 2 takes place the instant after the first one, and I love that.
It might as well be 3 seconds after the first one leaves off that Halloween 2 picks up. As long as it takes Donald Pleasance to run down the stairs of the house is where Halloween 2 picks up.
And I think that's great. I love it when movies do that.
So I would check this out. It continues the same night. Donald Pleasance, Jamie Lee Curtis. Quick run through of the story. She's taken to a hospital to recover from the ordeal in Halloween 1. And that would be the place of confinement where mayhem ensues with various nurses and doctors getting killed before he goes after Laurie again.
Awesome.
It's kind of a paint by number sequel, but not really. And you get more of the mythos in that movie. Specifically, there's a big twist that I'm not going to ruin for you because there's a huge reveal in that film. And it's toward the end of its second act that changes the relationship between Laurie Strode and Michael Myers. But it's a fun 80s sequel, and much better than you would think an 80s horror sequel would be. But H2O is a real interesting one because we're talking about this horror renaissance that Scream started. The movie was made because of that. H2O comes out in 1998. It's called H2O not because it has anything to do with water, but because it's H20. It's 20 years after 1978, the original film.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's the first time since Halloween 2 that Jamie Lee Curtis agrees to be in a Halloween film. Because after Halloween 2, she had done like 5 or 6 horror films and didn't want to do more because she didn't want to be typecast.
Yeah, the Scream Queen.
So she gave up on horror films, and that's when she started doing things like Trading Places and Fish Called Wanda and all that sort of stuff that we know her for now. But in 1988, she thinks it's a great idea to have this sort of anniversary film where she'll come back and she'll pick up where this character, Laurie Strode, is 20 years after the murders happen. And it's a real interesting psychological story with her. You see her, she's a very broken woman. She's an alcoholic. She's a recovering, you know, methadone addict with her son. And it's her son is being played by Josh Hartnett in his very first movie appearance.
Ha! Awesome.
It's got a hell of a cast, too, because Josh Hartnett is her son. And guess who his girlfriend is in the movie?
I have no idea.
Michelle Williams.
I love Michelle Williams. I remember her from, I first saw her in Dawson's Creek.
This is around her Dawson's Creek days. So he plays her girlfriend, and it concerns her. Laurie Strode is now, had faked her death and is living under a hidden identity in California. Michael manages to track her down, and we have another encounter. But what really made H2O great was it was the first time that Laurie turned it around and fought back. I mean, you see in Halloween 1 that she did fight back, and she's smarter than a lot of the girls in the film. But this is the time where she goes like full on Ripley and Aliens and actually fights back.
Awesome.
And it ends in a way where if that had been the last Halloween movie, it was a conclusive ending. And there was like there should have been no way that they could have made a sequel to that. And it's to me, it's one of the classic like great sequels in horror history and slasher history, certainly. So that's definitely up there for me.
I can't wait to watch the rest of those. I think I'm going to take your advice and just do the second one as well as H2O or H20, because I'm trying to watch the horror films that I haven't seen, and I'm embarrassed to say that I haven't seen, and that's definitely some of them.
See, but I know part of your hesitation is you don't have the patience that I do for some of the schlock that's out there. If you ask me, I will guide you to the sequels that you needed to see. And yes, with Halloween, I would say 1, 2, and H2O would be the ones that you want to check out.
Well, that is definitely going to happen this month, considering it's October. Well, I'm going to give a few rapid fire on my list so we can move this along. Because both you and I have so much on our list that we want to talk about. And some of my favorites are Indiana Jones 2 and 3, Wrath of Khan, Evil Dead 2, and Before Sunset. And the reason why I'm mentioning these is like Indiana Jones, I know a lot of people think that Temple of Doom is kind of the weak of the original trilogy, and I think I loved it as a kid.
Its greatest blessing is that 4 exists.
I'd have to agree with that. Yeah, like its greatest blessing is that Crystal Skull exists. It's like people are like, Temple of Doom's not looking so bad after all, huh?
I agree with you that I like that film. I think the weak point for me is Kate Capshaw.
Yeah, I mean, even as a fan of Temple of Doom, I have to admit that she can kind of bring it down a couple of times. But there are some really great moments between Ford and Capshaw, and I mean, when I was a kid, it was my favorite of the three, but when I became an adult, I feel like the third one, Last Crusade, is just something special. It's an amazing movie, and the dynamic between Sean Connery and Harrison Ford really sells the film, and I think, like, I mean, Raiders of the Lost Ark is iconic, it's fantastic, it's the original. 2 is fun, and 3 is just, it's in its own ballpark. And then you have Wrath of Khan, which is a sequel to the motion picture, and there's a lot of people who don't like the motion picture, but then there are a lot of people who are trying to, you know, rise up against those people and say, no, motion picture is a really great film. I personally did not like it. I appreciate it for what it was, for what it is, its aesthetic, but it's just so very dull and drone.
I don't like it either. And it's surprising considering that 2001 is one of my favorite films of all time, and it's often compared to that film, but...
Yeah, it's just I felt like there were so many things wrong with it, and Wrath of Khan recognized what was wrong with motion picture, and then bam, and said, we're going a different direction. And we could talk for ages on Wrath of Khan, but we're not going to, because this isn't a Star Trek podcast, but it is phenomenal. It hits everything right. And then you have something that's a little bit more in your wheelhouse. You have Evil Dead 2.
A different kind of sequel. It's not even really a sequel, because none of the Evil Dead sequel, well, save for Army of Darkness, is truly a sequel, because Evil Dead 2 is kind of a remake or a redo of that first one.
Right? Okay, I'm so glad that you brought this up, because...
But with a more comedic sense, whereas the first Evil Dead is played for horror.
Yeah, the first Evil Dead's played for horror. You have this very low-budget feel, because it was very low-budget. It was Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell when they were very young, just starting, and when they weren't calling him Ash, they were actually calling him Ashley. And it's just, it was all horror, and there was some really freaky stuff going on. And Evil Dead 2, like you said, it was a retelling of, like, the latter half of Evil Dead, where it didn't have any other characters. It was just Bruce. And it's, of the original characters, it was just Bruce, but then some other characters came along. It was really funny, but still kept that horror atmosphere. And then you have Army of Darkness, which was just... humor, and I like both of them.
I'm kind of an Army of Darkness guy, I have to say. I liked Evil Dead 2, but once they went into full slapstick, I was just that was sort of the thing that I really loved about that one.
Well, I mean, no, Evil, like, out of the three of them, Army of Darkness is my absolute favorite, because it's so absurd and so over the top. It's just funny. And speaking of quotable, I can't think of a movie that's more quotable than Army of Darkness.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, but the thing is, because Evil Dead 2 is a direct sequel from the first one, I feel like it had to be mentioned. And then you have Before Sunset, which is the sequel that's 10 years after the original. I love the original. Before Sunrise.
What I find fascinating about these films is that they're kind of like catch-up films, in the sense that they come out so far apart that it feels like each time they get together again, they're reuniting and catching up on life in a sense.
For the audience, like the original is, hey, these two people meet, and you get to know who they are, you get to learn who they are, and learn to love them. And then in the second one, it's, oh, this has been 10 years later, let's catch up. And so the audience is catching up, and they're catching each other up. And then in Before Midnight, for those of you who haven't seen, I'm not going to ruin anything for you, it's not so much a catch-up for them, but a catch-up for the audience. And they're all phenomenal. They're it's just talking. It's literally just talking. And in an age of tentpole movies and just over-the-top monster films, and in the age of Pacific Rim, Before Midnight, Before Sunset, and Before Sunrise are... You focus on the acting and you focus on the emotion, and you don't normally do that with a lot of films these days. And I feel like Before Sunset didn't try to do something weird. It didn't try to alter the formula. It didn't try to go darker. It just continued what worked in the first one. And you have two intriguing characters played by intriguing actors, and it was great.
Those are definitely some critically acclaimed films, and I can't fault you for them. Real quickly before we go on to bad ones, I'm just going to rapid fire some of the other ones that I won't spend too much time on. I mentioned 2001 being one of my favorite films of all time. The sequel, 2010, actually is a legit good film. It's got a good cast. It does what that sequel to that film should have done, which is explain some of the things but leave some things a mystery. Mm-hmm. And you've got great people like Roy Scheider, Helen Mirren, John Lithgow, Bob Balaban. It's got a solid cast, and it's a great follow-up to a classic film. Really like that one. And then real quickly, because I think it should be mentioned, this year I got a lot of sequels that I liked and really did, and we'll probably talk about them on some future show, but obviously Captain America 2, because reasons. And
no, that's an amazing movie. That is an amazing film. And I'm not a hardcore Marvel fanboy like you, but I hated First Avenger. I thought it was a crappy movie.
I didn't, but...
I fell asleep during it, and I could not stand it. And then Winter Soldier came out, and I was like, whoa! That's amazing. Yeah. And, like, even my wife, who does not like Marvel films, liked Winter Soldier.
So, I really liked that one. Again, it was our first show, but Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, great sequel. I actually like it more than Rise now, having seen both multiple times since... since our review. And I want to give a special shout out without having spoiled it for you, because it is coming into DVD in a couple weeks, but I want to give a special shout out to X-Men Days of Future Past.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet, and I am definitely going to pick that one up as soon as it comes out.
And I'll just say this much. It is a sequel. It is a sequel to both the original X-Men franchise, including X3, because at the beginning of this film, X3 and everything that came before is in continuity. And it's also a sequel to First Class, obviously, but it also manages to be a reboot. It's a sequel and a reboot, and it's done. There are so many ways that can go wrong, mm-hmm. and it's done in such a way that it's dramatic, it's powerful. No one gives a bad performance, in my opinion, and it was one of the best superhero movies to come out this year. So
definitely,
in my opinion, again, but definitely when it comes out on Blu-ray October 14th. So I would definitely recommend that you check out Days of Future Past.
Well, two films that I want to talk about. Actually, I don't even want to talk about them. I just want to list them before we get into movie sequels that didn't work. That's The Dark Knight and Toy Story 2. Now, you know that I'm a huge Batman fan, and The Dark Knight just almost broke the box office with how much money that it made. It's one of the top grossing films of all time. And I love Batman Begins, but this one just took it to a new level. Heath Ledger's performance as a Joker alone is enough to make this movie better than the original, or just a fantastic sequel that works. And it's just, I mean, it has its problems. It has some things wrong with it, but it's just fantastic. And Toy Story 2, it kept the feeling of the original, but added new characters and added new peril. And it's just a lot of fun. And those, I just wanted to say that before we moved on.
Okay. I agree with both of those choices, though I will say I'm a little bit more partial to Toy Story 3.
Well, oh, yes, I mean, you could mention that. I mean, that Toy Story 3 made you feel things you had no idea you were going to feel in this franchise.
Actively sobbing in the movie theater as a 21-year-old grown man.
I was laughing hysterically during the furnace scene. I was laughing hysterical, not because I thought it was funny, but because I was so utterly nervous and I couldn't believe what was happening in front of me, because I genuinely thought, is this going to happen?
Yeah, like, and the fact that that moment where they all join hands, like, we're going to die joined hands together.
Yeah. Yeah, no, not only was there a furnace where they're like, oh my gosh, they could bite it. No, they were accepting their fate as toys who are going to get melted into nothing, and they went in together as a family. And I was just like, I was in the theater, I was like, oh my god, is this really happening? I was just, I couldn't contain myself. It was this weird, nervous laughter, like, oh my god, I'm feeling so many things.
But I was just a mess at the end when, you know, Andy goes back to play with the toys one last time with the little girl that he's giving them away to, and, you know, the goodbye partner and all that sort of stuff. Oh, it really got to me.
Yeah, no, that hits you where you live. All right, well, before we go into the sequels that didn't work, I want to talk about some things that are a little ambiguous for a lot of people, at least as far as I'm concerned.
Let's hit Godfather 3. Come
like on. Godfather 3 and the Matrix sequels. Everybody hates Godfather Part 3. Everybody hates the Matrix sequels, but I enjoy them. Are they better than the original? No, not even close. But I think they're entertaining movies.
Now, Godfather 3 I haven't seen in a long time. But okay, the Matrix sequels I saw this last summer because a podcast that I like was doing a retrospective on them. So I rewatched them. Reloaded is okay. I feel like Revolutions is kind of a mess and trying to wrap everything up, though.
I feel the opposite way. I feel like Revolutions is a different tone and is like much more dramatic and much more symbolic, and Reloaded was just mindless action.
They both were kind of mindless action.
Well, yes, yeah, you're right. They're both, like, compared to the original, that's the thing, is that you can't compare to the original. The original was iconic and groundbreaking, and then you have these mindless action films, and that's what they were. And I kind of went into them that way. I was like, okay, I'm going to try to just see new movies in this universe and be entertained, and that's why I enjoyed them.
I think the problem that I and some of the other people had with it is that Matrix was a complete enough movie where, like, if there had never been a sequel to it, that would have been a good ending for me. Not that I'm necessarily opposed to a sequel to it, but if you're going to make a sequel to it, make it feel, you know, worthwhile and on that same, not necessarily on that same caliber, but try to keep some of the same quality to it, and don't make me feel like we're just kind of stretching things out over two films for the sake of stretching things out, which ultimately is kind of what it felt like to me.
Well, I can't really argue with that. Like, that's why, like, I put them in the middle, because there's not too much that I can argue or defend. It's just, like, everybody hates them, but I enjoy them and can take them at face value. And with Godfather Part 3, I feel like people say that they hate this film because they're supposed to say that they hate this film, and because people have been saying it for decades. And
I got two words for you.
I know, man. Okay, that's the thing, is that Sofia Coppola almost ruins this movie single-handedly, and she's a horrible actress. She's absolutely horrible. You could put it on mute during those scenes and you would still have the same emotional impact. And that's the problem, is that she is so just overwrought and horrible that you can't focus on anything else. But if you look at the story and the plot, it's much more complicated, it's much more in-depth, it's global, it involves a freaking pope. I mean, it's just... And, like, and we have this iconic scene with the helicopter and
the
round table.
Yeah, I was
going to
say that the ending has got to be one of the best parts about that third
one. And then you have, yeah, and then you have the ending where everybody gets their wish and Sofia Coppola gets shot. Like, and Andy Garcia is just phenomenal as he takes up the mantle of the Godfather. And no, I never thought that that would happen. Once you take Sofia Coppola out of it, it's one of the best films made. But you can't take Sofia Coppola out of it, so you got to take everything as its whole. You can't compartmentalize everything. So I enjoy Godfather Part 3 because I love those characters. I love that director. I love that aesthetic. I love that universe.
Right.
But I cannot defend Sofia Coppola in
right.
the least.
And it's going to... By saying that, you do realize that it's going to be an anchor for a lot of people. It's going to weigh them down when it comes to reviewing that third movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's the thing, is that I cannot argue against you if you don't like Godfather Part 3. It's very personal opinion. I love it and I wish that I could cut her out, but I can't. And so I feel for those who don't like it.
Well, how about we talk about the sequels that we wish we could cut out the whole film?
Let's do that. And so how about you give me... I only have five on my list because I hate being negative, and I'd like to keep this one, this section a little bit short. But yeah, give me yours. Give me yours.
I have two that really bother me a lot, but they both share a common theme, which is I don't like sequels that basically undo the last film if the last film was really good, just for the sake of going in a new direction.
Okay.
You know what I mean? They'll throw away... In the two examples that I'm going to bring up, they throw away characters that I like for no reason other than we want to do something different, so, and these characters really don't fit in, so screw it. If you liked them in the last film, too bad. You know, that sort of thing. And one we're going to talk about soon, and one is Alien 3. Because being an Aliens fan, I really liked that movie. I think that it had my favorite cast of the Alien films, and I got really invested in the survivors, and that first 5 minutes of Alien 3 just completely ruins it for me.
Yeah, I like Alien 3.
I know you do, and I a lot of people do. It's a divisive film, but
yeah.
It's a combination of throwing away those characters from Aliens that worked. You know, I felt like they earned their survival, and they go out in such a cheap way.
I can't argue with that.
To the fact that I don't really... I like David Fincher now. As a matter of fact, I just saw Gone Girl over the weekend, and that was a phenomenal movie. And I like his aesthetic now, but I just... That movie is so depressing. And it just... we'll talk about this more when we get to our Aliens talk, but I just don't like the way that kind of... The warrior woman that I saw Sigourney Weaver and Ripley grow into just kind of goes through the movie, like, defeated and given up. Like, it just feels like nothing she does matters. Why even bother? That's the kind of attitude that she has throughout the whole film. And it just weighs on me. And I didn't want to go that way. But my absolute... If I could delete a movie from history, it would absolutely be the film that came after, inexplicably, I should say, came after Halloween H2O, and that's Halloween Resurrection from 2002. And it does... I'll just spoil some of the stuff that happens in this because I don't want you or anyone else to see this film. But in Halloween Resurrection, Halloween H2O ends... I'll just spoil this up front because you'll still like it anyway. It's still a good film. Halloween H2O ends with Jamie Lee Curtis, Laurie Strode, chopping off Michael Myers' head.
Okay.
Like, it should be over. The man is decapitated. And it feels like a good ending, and it feels like Laurie won. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Halloween Resurrection picks up 3 years later, and they do this whole situation where it picks up with Laurie Strode is in a mental institution because it's revealed through retcon that, oops, Michael switched places with a paramedic, and she accidentally chopped off the paramedic's head at the end of H2O. So the first 15 minutes of Resurrection consists of Laurie in a mental institution. Michael comes chasing after her. She traps him in a self-made trap that I don't know how she got access to on the roof of this institution if she's supposed to be locked up. She gets him and is going to kill him when he fakes her out by pretending like, oh, it's not really him again. And she wants to take off his mask and make sure that it's really him. And he grabs her. They go over the roof of the institution. And she gets stabbed and is left for dead. So that's how they take out the Laurie Strode character. And that's really, really anticlimactic to me. And the rest of the film is just this sort of Blair Witch, reality TV, exploring the Michael Myers house with Busta Rhymes and Tyra Banks. And it is... one of the worst films I've ever seen. Like, I've never seen a horror franchise go so far downhill than it does in Resurrection, to the point where, like I said in my previous stories, when Rob Zombie was going to reboot the series, I was okay with it because Resurrection was the film that came before it, and there was no way to pick up from that.
It atrocious.
It just went so far downhill, and it killed everything I liked about the last film, so... I don't even acknowledge it exists. For me, the original Halloween series ends with H2O.
You had me at Busta Rhymes and Tyra Banks.
Oh, it gets worse because you have Busta Rhymes karate chopping Michael Myers in this film. and him busting through doors and saying trick or treat mother effer, and you know, stuff like lines to that caliber of quality.
Well, I mean, you inspired me to be a little bit more selective with mine, so I'm not going to give the 5. I'm going to give it down to 3, and we're not, even though we talked about Crystal Skull a little bit, I'm not going to mention that one because why give it credence? So my final 3 are Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, Men in Black 2, and the worst sequel of all time, in my opinion, is Batman and Robin.
How did I know that was going to be on your list?
Yeah, like Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, holy crap! I saw this in the theater, and it's just so bad. It's so bad. It has none of the spirit of the first one. It takes little things that were kind of interesting in the first one and kind of cute, and then multiplies them by 1,000 and saying like, oh, if you like this, you're going to love this because we took a magnifying glass to it and then smack you in the face with it. The thing that I wanted for Pirates of the Caribbean 2 was the journey of Jack Sparrow. Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl, should have been an isolated incident where we have Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley, and they exist only in that movie. That's it. The only place that those characters exist, including Balboa, Jeffrey Rush, should be in The Curse of the Black Pearl. But no, they're like, no, it's the dynamic that's fun, and so we're going to stretch this out over 2 more movies and then ruin the first one for you. It's just, I don't understand how people like this movie. I don't understand how this franchise keeps making money. Because then you have the 4th one, which I don't even remember what it's called.
On Stranger Tides.
Wait, is that the 4th one?
That's the 4th one. The 3rd one was At World's End.
That's right, At World's End, which was even worse than Dead Man's Chest.
I was going to ask you, since you consider 2 to be one of your least favorite, I was going to ask you how you felt about 3.
The reason why I bring up 2 is because it was beginning of the end.
Okay.
And then you have the 4th one, like I said, which I thought was like, okay, finally, maybe they'll redeem themselves because it doesn't have Keira Knightley and Orlando Bloom and Jeffrey Rush in it. And it's what I wanted for the 2nd one, but it was just too far gone. It was too late. You have a deaf, naked mermaid, and then you have Penelope Cruz completely wasted in it. Not wasted as in drunk, but just wasted because I like her as an actress. And then it's directed by Rob Marshall, who's known for 9 and Chicago. I was like, oh yeah, he's a perfect choice for an action swashbuckler.
Yeah.
No. And I'm a fan of Rob Marshall, and it was just horrible. And then you have Men in Black 2, which this one is unique because Men in Black was so successful and so low budget. Like, people don't understand how low budget it actually was and how much money it made. It was so successful and so great. It was almost independent.
It kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah, no one had any faith in it, and it just became the blockbuster of the year. And then when Men in Black 2 came out, they just threw money at it, and they threw money at it, and they threw money at it. And when you throw a lot of money at something, you have a lot of executive producers. You have a lot of studios who have stake in it. And so they think that they need to have every single person there. They need to have their company stooge there saying, oh, we have a lot of money in this, so you need to do what we say. Yeah. So instead of letting the director and the writer do their vision, it was a lot of company interfering. And I feel like that was what's ruined Men in Black 2, because they didn't get to do it. Like, if you read the original script, you're like, wow, this is a whole lot cooler than what came out. But then I liked Men in Black 3. I felt like they kind of redeemed themselves.
A lot of people felt that that was a return to form.
It was very much. I think you always have a knack for key phrases for like summing up what I'm trying to say. And it's true to form. It came back to a feeling of the original, and it was just, it brought the fun back to it. And then there's Batman and Robin, and
need you say more?
And yeah, that's the thing, is like, I don't need to say anything more. Like, everybody knows it. It's horrible. It's
what hasn't been said in the last 17 years.
Yeah, I mean, even the freaking director apologized for the almost killing Batman in film. That's all that needs to be said. And so I think we can wrap it up there.
So we had a lot of material on sequels, and we could probably go for hours and hours more, but that's just kind of sequels in a nutshell. And as we talk about more franchises and directors on this film, I'm sure we're going to revisit some of these, and we'll be able to talk more in depth on that later.
Absolutely. And we kept saying the phrase, well, we'll wait for the retrospective. And that's because we love these movies so much that we want to do an entire episode just on those. And, you know, there's a lot of sequels that we probably missed that you guys love that you think is either better than the original or just work just as well as the original. So email us at contact@thenerdparty.com. You can find it on our website. And please go to thenerdparty.com and go to our iTunes page. Leave us a 5-star review. And if you do, we'll mention you on the podcast. And if you're a Stitcher fan or a Spreaker fan or wherever you listen, you can give us a rating. And if you do it outside the U.S., send us an email so that we know that you did it. And you can also find us online on Twitter. You can find me at TheInsaneRobin.
And you can find me at MHansen0207, H-A-N-S-E-N.
We thank you for listening, and this has been The Nerd Party.
Coming up next week.
Okay, looks like we've escaped. Let's just assume everything is safe and step outside.
Wait a second. This feels very familiar. If there's anything I've learned, it's that these things like to hide on the escape craft right at the end. How about we scan for movement before we just walk out and... Yep, it's hiding in the landing gear.
Oh, good call. Who knows what could happen?
You're mostly dead now.
Mostly.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.